Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midraps with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. We're going to focus on NATO as it stands here in the second decade of the 21st century and how it's come to where it is right now and where it may be going. NATO is working on a decade of extended combat operations and has more ones coming in. NATO is in the process, as any organization is, of changing and evolving. So we want to talk about what it has become and where it might be going. We also would like to touch on something that is very near and dear, especially to our new NATO members, and that is Russia, how she has recovered and changed over the last 20 years, and what are the implications for our NATO allies, but also many of our partners and friends there in what the Russians will call the near abroad. And for the full hour, our guests to discuss these things, and probably a couple of other ones, will be Dr. Thomas Fedison, Captain, United States Navy, retired. He is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and chair of the Europe-Russia Studies Group. Tom, welcome to Midraps.
Well, Sal, thank you very much for having me today.
And very good to cover you. We've got Eagle One, you and me, over 1,000 miles, and we're still able to have a show. Before the show, Eagle One and I were kind of joking that it was very nice of the Secretary of Defense Gates to prepare the opening question for us for today's show. And I know, as most of our listeners are aware, in Oslo this week, as he's going out the door, the Secretary of Defense Gates, he kind of channeled something that reminded me in some ways, and you can find the video for the listeners over at my home blog, of when General Craddock, which is Admiral Stavridis' predecessor, is SACUR. When he left, he gave a rather scathing indictment of ongoing problems with NATO and what can be called a two-tiered or a three-tiered alliance. And it's nothing that we haven't heard before, but this seemed to get a bit more traction, perhaps because it came from a civilian by somebody in uniform. If you could, Tom, kind of looking at the issues that Secretary Defense Gates brought up. Is he making a comment on an inflection point that the alliance may be coming to?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, he's not the first one to say it. This is not the first time we've heard these words. I mean, his words were pretty tough. To quote him, he said, "Dim, if not dismal, future." I think that's a little bit harsh. Nonetheless, it's a very clear point that NATO right now, or let's put it this way, the world has changed sufficiently over the last 20-plus years, and NATO is not responding to it in what I would consider a healthy and correct way. In that, NATO continues to insist on, how shall we call it, being a team in the major leagues when perhaps it ought to look for a AAA status.
Eagle One?
Oh, well, that's an interesting point. I mean, what other choices are there? I mean, there's the major league, and you talk about AAA, but what other organizations, international organizations, do you see out there that would qualify as AAA?
Well, when I say, I mean, I'll use the baseball analogy, but what I'm driving at is the difference between a security alliance, which is really life and death. you know, back in 1949, the Soviets really were intent on invading Western Europe and ultimately attacking the United States. We needed NATO, and we needed our European members to exist. Now, the last two strategies that NATO has written has essentially said that there's not an enemy out there that threatens our existence. Clearly, Russia is not that enemy. And so a major league alliance worries about your existence. A AAA alliance, I would say, does the other stuff that doesn't have much to do with existence. Now, the other stuff is darned important in today's world. Instability, humanitarian, perhaps even regime change. I mean, you might get a little bit on the borderline there. But still, nothing that's happening in Libya, for example, today threatens American existence. So as long as NATO continues to pretend that it's in the game of being an existential alliance, then I think it's taking on too much. And I wrote a piece about a year ago that addressed that. Now, let me give you a quick summary of it. My proposal is that NATO continue doing everything it's doing today because it does it so darn well, and it really is the most successful alliance in the history of the world. What I don't want it to do, though, is to give a security guarantee to every nation out there who is a member. In other words, we will fight to the death of the last American for Estonian boundaries. The reason that I say that is because, you know, Russia isn't the enemy anymore. And if Russia isn't the enemy, why do we have to say that? Russia looks at the security guarantee that NATO gives and I think correctly surmises that we can still consider them an enemy, even though we don't say that we do. I mean, after all, if not Russia, who are we worried about with this security guarantee? So my simple proposal was eliminate the security guarantee. Russia comes on board, maybe other people come on board too, and you then have an alliance capable of handling all the other sundries, all the other difficulties of this turbulent world that we live in, and can do it. I mean, these aren't the things that require trillion-dollar defense budgets. These are smaller items, but these are items where lots of partners do matter. And there are lots of things out there that really are still very important, like I said, in the humanitarian world. So what this does is sort of defangs Russia to a great extent. But if we don't do that, Russia will forever consider that NATO is a threat to Russia and will act accordingly. The other bad side of that is when you're talking about an alliance looking at major powers out there that are your enemy, you really do have to fund that alliance with big defense budgets. And frankly, that's not going to happen in Europe. It might not even happen in the United States over the next few years, but certainly there is almost no European nation that ponies up. And so it's already a charade in that regard.
That's a, Tom, that's a nice lead-in to one of the questions of the interaction between NATO and the in Russia. This always kind of perplexed me because I almost take the Russian view of things. Is, and I think part of the problem that we have as Americans, I think the Europeans are a little better at this than we are, is Russia is not a Western nation. Russia is not an Asian nation. Russia is Russia, if you want to think about their mindset. But there, I think there's one thing that more than many nations that Russia has, is it's not so much a paranoia, but as an insecurity that's reinforced by their history. And I have had trouble wrapping my head around the fact that when you look at Russia from a demographics point of view, what her interests are for her people, now that it's not wrapped up in the expansionistic, communistic, larger view of things from a philosophy point of view, there's really no reason why Russia would want to head into Western Europe anytime. So why give them a reason to be paranoid? But we seem to be headed further east to put American forces, regardless of how we cage it, in Poland and other places in the former Warsaw Pact, almost I would see where a Russian nationalist would go, why? Why are you poking your finger in the eye? Are we unnecessarily, for whatever the reasons we're doing this, making a strategic blunder and giving certain aspects of the Russian culture an excuse to look west and not see a friend, but see somebody that may have other means and alternative reasons for doing things?
I couldn't have said it better. That's precisely one of the points that I was trying to make in that article last year. We are giving Russia reason to be suspect of us. And as long as they are, now I realize they're not the superpower that they used to be, they will stand on the sidelines. Let's look at Libya, for example. How long did it take Russia to so far as make a proclamation in support of the NATO movement there? About a month. Now, honestly, it could have happened within minutes. But Russia, I think, goes back into the Kremlin and said, my God, we are still suspect of NATO, and it takes probably a lot of catfighting in the Kremlin for them to ultimately come out on what I would have thought would have been a simple and easy decision. The bottom line is that I think that it is unnecessary, and I think it's all about Article 5, that security guarantee, and I think we should give that up. I mean, I think you're right, the way you characterize Russia. I lived there several years. I was a naval attaché there about 10 years ago. And you're absolutely right about them being suspect about the West. And, I mean, there's a lot of things about their culture that is different from ours. But what I do see now is that no longer is there this sense of, you know, you put it, communistic expansionism. That's not there at all. There are people, I mean, they're not Americans. They don't, for example, treasure personal freedoms as much as Americans do. They do like national security maybe a little bit more than we do. They're willing to give up some of their freedoms in order to get that security. But increasingly, there are people who simply want to live better. And their economy hasn't been doing too badly lately. I mean, mostly as a result of the high price of oil. Nonetheless, their economy isn't in bad shape, and the people are living better. In reality, what you have right now, and this is another one of the reasons that NATO has problems, is there's already sort of an economic entente between Russia and Germany and Russia and many European countries, because Russia provides the principal source of oil and gas for them. Almost silly for them to want to take on Russia with this Article 5 security guarantee, when at the same time they know that they need Russia in order to keep their homes warm in winter.
Well, I'm going to go to a much simpler question, being a simple guy, but if the main reason for NATO's existence has ceased to be the threat from the Soviet Union, why do we need NATO, and aren't there other organizations, the EU, the UN, and something else that are already doing the jobs that we would assign to the new NATO, which is not worried about the Soviet Union?
No, I don't agree with you there. 20 years ago, I worked for NATO at the time when they were doing their first strategic concept after the fall of the Soviet Union, and the strategy that they wrote back then was significantly different in that it wasn't all just about fighting upcoming wars. It expanded NATO's charter into dialogue, into cooperation, into turning the rest of the world into more democratic, responsive organizations. Now, I'm not saying that another institution couldn't do this, but what NATO did 20 years ago was expand its charter into non-existential security things. Could other outfits do them? Yeah. But the beauty of NATO is that the organizations, the efficiencies, the camaraderie within NATO was so good that it turned out to be a perfect organization to foster, you know, what we call now the Partnership for Peace. There are so many initiatives going on that NATO is running that maybe the EU could have run, but when given the opportunity, they didn't have the organization that NATO had. That NATO is doing such a wonderful job in so many areas that I think there is a time and a place for NATO. I go back to it could be a pennant winner in a AAA league, which is to say in the world of cooperation in terms of defense institution building. Just in simple dialogue, Western cultures versus other cultures, it's done so well, it can continue to do so well. I'll just give you a quick anecdote. I just came back from Azerbaijan 2 weeks ago, and I, as well as scholars from other NATO nations, in this case Poland and the Czech Republic, are putting together effectively a curriculum for their national war college. The stuff that their students are going to be learning are going to be essentially the same stuff that I'm teaching at the Naval War College. The thought process, the ability for the students to talk amongst themselves, in other words, to get out of that old Stalinist mold of learning by rote, you know, the fact that there is not a stock answer to any question, the Western way of thinking about security. We're exporting that quietly and subtly all around the world. What I'm doing in Azerbaijan is just one of many such projects. NATO's doing it. Not the EU, not the UN, not anybody else. NATO's doing it. And I think there is absolutely a strong role for NATO in the security world as long as they back off of, you know, projecting major combat operations against another superpower.
I think you're kind of hitting that. You can almost see emerging from the mist, you know, where NATO is going. You had the old NATO that we knew as kids, which was the big, you know, defend the fold the gap against the Soviet Union organization. Then you saw after the fall of the Soviet Union, it kind of broke its adhesions in the Balkans and stuck its toe in the waters and something else. And then in late 2005, in early 2006, when it took over the Afghan operations under the ISAF umbrella for, you know, outside of the capital with the whole thing, it kind of thought it wanted to be a warfighting organization. But since then, we've seen the caveats in Afghanistan. Just I remember when I was there, you know, talking to a Belgian there at the Kabul airport. He's like, yeah, you know, if you get in trouble here, I can help you. But at the corner of the street there or something happens, I can't do anything to you. Just ridiculous things. And we also saw that the caveats off of Hoa. We see what's going on in Libya right now where you're almost a three-tier organization. But it does do things very, very well, training, exercises, partnerships, helping other nations. If we can do something along the lines that you said, get away from the Article 5, which I think, you know, the bulk of the nations like Poland, Estonia and stuff, their hair will catch on fire. But that really would leverage what NATO is best at. And if there's a hot war that needs to be done, then it'll just be a coalition of the willing, because that's kind of where we are right now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think that you have to draw the line at kinetics. I think NATO can still do small kinetics. I don't think that NATO should think about major combat operations against a big power. But, for example, some of the work that was done in the Balkans I thought was probably about appropriate. Of course, it's never easy running a war, you know, with 28 different players and they're making decisions. But still, if the scale of combat is such that it's still tractable, I don't see any reason that NATO can't stay in the business of violence. But major violence, I think, is too hard. I think NATO partners have already voted with their pocketbooks against major violence. Now, you know, exactly where do you draw the line? I mean, is Libya that line? Maybe it is. Here we are, 2 months into Libya, and the British and the French stocks of armaments are running out. Now, to their credit, you know, they really ran this show. They're getting support from the United States, but they're principally doing the warfighting. A Canadian general is in charge. The Belgians are doing a lot, the Danes, the Norwegians. But they just don't have the wherewithal to do high-intensity war for a long time. So NATO and Libya, I don't know. That's one of those gray areas. I don't know whether NATO's gone a little bit too far, maybe underestimated the cost of what it would be. But smaller kinetic problems, I think, assuming NATO is unanimously supportive of the operation. I think that's still a feasibility. But like I said, NATO can't do big stuff anymore, and if for no other reason, it's just because the money's not there. And as Secretary Gates said, you know, if the American taxpayer is going to be increasingly disaffected also. So the United States, which was always the anchor to windward here, may not be there for the big combat either.
Well, so much of that, the role the United States took after World War II was to allow European countries and Japan to rebuild themselves. Now that they've kind of caught up, if you will, we're an economic powerhouse, but they're not the weak sisters they were in 1946. And I guess, you know, part of the question is, if you're one of the NATO members, at what point do you have to look around at yourself and look back at yourself and say, we really are going to take our military capabilities seriously here and devote more than 0.5% of our GDP to the military? Is that just unrealistic in today's world?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I've spent a number of years in Brussels, too, and I think it is. They're given about 1.2% of their it's above 0.5%, but it's still trivial by American standards. You talk to most Europeans, and they're not at all uncomfortable with only spending 1.2% of their GNP for defense. As far as they're concerned, that may be just about right. They do not feel existentially threatened. Well, why spend so much on defense if you really don't feel threatened? You can cover small operations. You can cover anti-piracy operations and a few other things like that for 1.5% of your GDP. But in order to fight wars, you need 3 or 4%. And I don't see the political will in most NATO members right now want to spend that kind of money. And then you throw this recession and the euro crisis and everything else on top of that. I think it's simply, in this day and age, unrealistic. Now, you know, that's the negative side of things. On the positive side of things, I don't know if we ever stop and appreciate just how darn successful NATO has been. You know, 60 years, 28 nations, no major wars. I mean, name me another alliance in the history of the world that came close to any of those numbers. I mean, it's Ruthian in a way, as if there were a league of alliances. So, you know, nothing to be ashamed of. It's just that I think that the world has changed now, and I just don't see the will on the part of the Europeans to continue to do what NATO used to do. However, as I said before, I don't want to throw in the towel. I think it's too good an institution doing some things to throw this baby out with the bathwater.
And I share your affection for NATO as well. And like with many things you have affection with, occasionally you have to practice a little bit of tough love. Over in the chat room, Mary brought up a comment that over on Twitter yesterday, Admiral Stavridis mentioned something that I think is a nice venue that Americans should know to really see a lot of the European mindset when it comes to NATO. He was very excitedly tweeted that they're making some grand reorganizations there, going from 11 to 7 major staff commands there. And anybody that does a NATO tour knows that right next to the World Cup, the most critical thing in any NATO staff is the flags to post that come out, because a lot of these nations, they really benchmark how many flag billets they have upon the NATO staff structure. While Americans who are CONUS-based in the mindset kind of look at NATO, what we've been talking about to this point, which is, you know, what does it buy us operationally? And one thing I've been bouncing around for a while, the organization is good, but a lot of that mindset where they don't see the need to spend much is, if you've ever done or been involved in filling out the combined joint statement of requirements for an organization, when the lines are blank, they always look at America. And part of that is the fact that we still have so many forces and so many Americans over there in Europe. could we move towards something where we have some nice combined joint logistics and training bases, you know, Grafenwehr, Ramstein with Landstuhl attached to it, maybe Lakenheath, keep a couple things in Italy for the Navy. But besides that, take everybody home, and when there's a crisis, let the Europeans take a deep breath and say, what could we do if Uncle Sam doesn't come? Would that help the situation any, or is the mindset too set otherwise?
No, I think we're moving in that direction. I think the writing's on the wall. I think Admiral Stavridis is doing what he can do to streamline the operation. I think everyone realizes that the trend is going to be downward, and that there is going to be American pullback. And I favor that. I have been supporting pullback for some time, and ultimately it has to become more economical. Now, I accept what you said earlier about the flag ratio, and NATO members do care a lot about that. That, I think, is partly just the price of doing business in an alliance, and I don't savor the fact that it exists, but I kind of acknowledge it and recognize it, and I look at the world today and I say, we've got a world in which most of the problems that we're facing really can only be handled by large groups of nations. You know, one nation doesn't stand up and solve the world's problems anymore. Call it globalization, put whatever tag on it you want. You've got to have guys in your camp. And so if it means that every now and then we've got to, you know, let a Romanian command something that maybe they don't deserve to command because they haven't ponied up enough ships, so be it. Nonetheless, I see and hope for, especially with Admiral Stavridis, who I trust implicitly here, a graceful degradation such that if we lose some of our combat capability, you know, like in the fold of gap, I can live with that. But the kinds of combat capability that we need to have needs to be smaller order, flexible, maneuverable, deployable, high tech. We can still do that, and we can do that more cheaply than we're doing it today. And I'll go back to that first point, just back off the big divisions, the battle fleets and things like that, and do what needs to be done today against those non-existential security threats.
Eagle One?
Yeah, I keep going back to this is just an experiential thing for me. We're having served in AFSouth during the part of the Kosovo War, I was amused by your comment about how hard it is to do things with 28 ALA. And I don't know how it was in Brussels for you, but trying to get simple things done seemed to take forever because everybody had a vote. People would then offer up troops or something, and then they would announce the last minute that they didn't really mean it. Was that changed in NATO, or is that just part of the way that structure works?
I hear that it does. My guess, and I haven't served in NATO for some number of years, my guess is that no. Again, you have 20 people sitting at the committee table, there will always be difficulties in getting things done. I had the opportunity back then to run the ops center for the ambassadors and for the military committee because I was the branch chief for Russian affairs. And as soon as the Kosovo War started, all of the Russians in Brussels left in protest. And so I became the Maytag repairman. I and my branch had nobody to talk to. And so the German general, who was the ops director at the time, said, hey, 9 unemployed O6s, will you guys come down and run my ops center for me? So I became in charge of the ops center. It was frustrating, if you look at it from a purely American military staff perspective, because politics had to be played, and the ambassadors played their political cards every day. But I've seen NATO fret and worry and slow roll over many more things, much worse than they do in the Kosovo War. So, again, one of those prices of doing business. Maybe it didn't look quite as bad for the ambassadors as it did for you, and I know it wasn't perfect, but ultimately I think the job did get done.
When you coined the phrase graceful degradation, I like that. That sounds like a good article right there. I like that. I'd love to spend an hour just talking about that concept. I might steal that, Tom. I like that.
Okay, you got it.
It kind of brought to mind an article that I find myself going back to on a regular basis. It's Robert Kaplan's article in The Atlantic back in November of 07, titled America's Elegant Decline. You know, if you think of NATO's elegant decline, and if it's an organization which I think, if it's done right and allowed to change and adjust, is invaluable for the reasons you've outlined earlier. As I remember a few years ago, there was a lot of discussions. A few years ago, I'm talking about 07, 08 timeframe, about what would we need to do to bring in a lot of the nations who were helping us in Afghanistan. We're talking about Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Japan, or even out of the box, you know, Chile. These are established democratic governments that have a history of relative transparency and have a lot of the same values NATO shares. But NATO, the North Atlantic part, kind of limits that. Partnership for Peace and the other thing, outreach that NATO have, it is helpful. But if NATO is going to continue to adjust to be relevant and maybe emphasize its core competency, is there some things that NATO could change that could allow those countries and maybe a couple more to be more integrated into what NATO will be doing going forward that it's really good at?
Yeah. In fact, let me steal your idea if I haven't already stolen it, and at least in one article a year ago. But that's exactly the point. If things need to be done, I argue for NATO because it has been the most effective organization for doing things in the world for the last 60 years. But why is it, for example, that we can't get universal willingness to join up to things that we do? Well, it's probably two things. And first and foremost is the name. So maybe we do need to change the name. But secondly, I think it's the fact that we talk about this security guarantee, and that certainly keeps Russia from playing ball, but I would have to guess that an Australia or a Japan would probably look at NATO and say, oh, they're still transfixed on the fold the gap. They're still transfixed on the security guarantee. It's difficult to believe that they can really put their hearts and their, you know, entire bodies into, let's just say, global humanitarian endeavors when their charter requires them to be transfixed in the European theater. So I would argue, hey, you know, what's in a name? I don't know, maybe in this case, less than meets the eye. Go ahead, change that name, and go ahead and change that charter. And then I think you'll get the Chile's, Australia's, Japan's, Russia's, and China's of the world saying, maybe these guys aren't so bad after all.
Yeah, I'm curious about countries that joined NATO fairly late. At least when I was playing in the world, the Poles, the Hungarians, the Czechs, you know, they all seem to be much more enthusiastic about NATO as they were signing up than a lot of the older members. What do we do about there? Are they there because of Article 5? Do they see a threat we don't see, or is it just history and they haven't quite gotten over that history probably is no longer relevant?
No, they're the biggest fans of Article 5. There's little doubt about that. And they are the people who will scream bloody murder if anybody says anything bad about Article 5. I mean, to generalize, a bunch of them really don't like the Russians and really do worry about the Russians. And so, to some extent, it's a coin flip. Do you want to move into the future in a world where everybody's on board doing things, humanitarian sorts of things, or do you stick with the old way of doing business? Now, Estonia, for example, would have a fit if all of a sudden we talk about dropping Article 5. I would say you've got to choose. I mean, what is more important? Back when Estonia joined up, and it was, you know, it was a great PR success, and you know, everything was positive for NATO. But if at the end of the day, NATO's existence demands giving up Article 5 for the Estonians, I would ask the Estonians to go ahead and make that call. What means more to you? Right now, I think it's a losing bet, but certainly countries like Estonia consider Article 5 as absolutely the be-all and end-all of NATO, and that without it, NATO is worthless to them. And I would say if that's really true, then go ahead and vote. But, you know, Article 5 is a little bit like, you know, some shibboleths in American politics. It's like a theology. When people say it, people genuflect. You know, it's holy writ, and I realize you just can't walk away from holy writ overnight. But I think we should make it a little less holy and be able to step away from it a little bit.
Yeah, I think having a culture in NATO where you walk into the pointy bits as opposed to running the other way would really help a lot to move forward. Because I mean, you know what it's like. If there's a little pointy edge somewhere, nobody wants to get near it because that's just too much trouble. Let's go down the nice soft path here. But, you know, that being said, I think history also shows something about NATO that it's more resilient, I think, than we give it credit. I mean, it survived the Greek and Turkish challenge over Cyprus. But we saw this week the Norwegians, which have done some heavy lifting, and you have to give the credit, especially in Afghanistan, the Danes and the Estonians, some of our smaller nations. You know, Estonia has a population of, 1.3 million. The Danes and the Norwegians, 5.5 million, and we have metro areas larger than that. They've done what they can, have given the size, but they've announced that as of 1 August, stick a fork in them, they're done, they're leaving. And I guess there's a concern there, kind of like you saw with the Dutch and the Canadians in Afghanistan. Once a couple of players go for the door, others will follow. If the Libya situation does not resolve itself and it's left to be an Anglo-French-American deal going into the fall, there's a lot of known unknowns here. How much risk is NATO taking on Libya, and where do we go if more alliance members just quit?
I'm with you on that. I was afraid that Libya might have been a bridge too far when it started. I was buoyed when I saw the way, especially the French and the Brits, took the lead on this. My concern all throughout has been there wouldn't be enough there, and unless NATO won a very quick war, that they would, like they are today, start running out of bullets. I was very pleased with the American response when we were acting essentially in a supportive role. Not that we're doing nothing, we're doing a lot. We're just, other than the original flourish of Tomahawk missiles, we're just not shooting too many rockets and missiles anymore, but we're still flying a lot of airplanes. I have that same concern. It does appear that you know the river is moving correctly in our direction, and people are now talking about when, not if, Gaddafi leaves. But I fear that if it goes on another month or two, it really could have some negative repercussions in the alliance because a lot of nations have already bailed, and I think that more, you know, success breeds success. If we can't make a success quickly, I fear that the Brits and the French are going to be looking around pretty much in us and pretty much by ourselves and saying, now what? Do we want to lay down another $1 billion over this cause, which now 3 and 4 and 5 months into it is not producing what we wanted? I'll be guardedly optimistic. I'll say that because I'm reading more positive press accounts on Libya today than I did a month ago, I'm hoping that it does come out better or well, and that NATO can regroup and perhaps learn a lesson from it. you know, understand where the fire breaks are. Understand when an operation is just so kinetic that they're not going to be able to pull it off. They've got to fall down into the triple A's again from the majors.
Well, that, you know, that really doesn't bode well for the humanitarian operations, which we seem to be willing to undertake, or people are always encouraging NATO or the U.S. or other countries to undertake, because if it goes more than a couple of weeks, or in this case a couple of months, apparently nobody except the U.S. has the wherewithal to hang in there that long. And then what have you done? You've gone all kinetic, but what are you left with, and what does NATO or any other force do then? How do you pick up the pieces if you were to, you know, decide tomorrow that Libya wasn't worth it, everybody pulled out? What happens then? What humanitarian good have we done? And is that NATO's fault, or is it just a mess of the way life works?
Well, I use the word humanitarian, and of course there's a wide spectrum of things that fall under humanitarian. Conducting a two-month kinetic high-tech war for a humanitarian cause is on the very far end of that humanitarian spectrum. Most humanitarian ops are, you know, tsunamis and hurricanes and capsized vehicles and things like that. The sorts of things that can be financed, 9 out of 10 of them are completely within the budgetary limits of NATO. It's that one that's at pushing the envelope, this high-tech war that we're fighting now with Tomahawks and electrons and, you know, all kinds of, you know, spies in the sky and that whole business. That costs serious money. And I almost hesitate to put that in the humanitarian box, but I certainly do understand that it is. I just think it's pushing the limit.
Yeah, well, let me follow up for a second, because the second largest army or military in NATO, Turkey, is not involved, other than withdrawing their own people, in Libya. And I'm also curious, because now they're looking at somebody recently in the White House called Syria a potential humanitarian crisis. I'm beginning to wonder, as we get closer to one of our allies, what, you know, and they're getting cross-border traffic, are we going to see, is NATO going to bite off another piece, or is the U.S. going to, you know, how are we going to resolve these issues? They're right on the doorstep of the Mediterranean and a lot of our NATO allies.
Fair question. Now, I'd say we should absolutely talk about it. Let the 28 nations sit down in Brussels and talk and listen to what Turkey has to say. And if it turns out that Turkey is going to be in need of NATO military forces helping what might be a humanitarian disaster, let NATO have a day in court. The likelihood, I mean, it's easy for me to say that here, but the likelihood that this turns into another, you know, high-tech war like we're having in Libya, I think it's less. But I think at least we do need to talk about it. Certainly, Secretary Gates wasn't too kind to Turkey. He kind of let Turkey have it because Turkey wasn't doing nearly as much as he thought they ought to be doing in Afghanistan. Nonetheless, Turkey's been a fantastic ally for a long time, and if Turkey feels that it needs NATO help, it should be, you know, we should certainly listen to Turkey's request and give it a fair shake. If for no other reason, Turkey, an ascendant economy, a lot of people say the bridge between the West and the East, increasingly becoming independent and willing to act on its own and not just as part of the NATO alliance, I don't think Turkey is one of these sorts of nations that we should snub. Turkey is one of these nations that is going to be increasingly important and powerful in the world. They have been a good, reliable NATO ally for a long time. And what they're asking for, we should be serious about this request.
Yeah, the news on Turkey that caught my attention, just thinking about the American equivalent, is I think earlier this week they arrested the president of their war college for conspiring to overthrow the government. So there's a novel for you to take into play. moving around to the east of Turkey and going back to Russia for a minute, you know, when you look at minus what happened in 9/11, when you look at terrorist attacks and nations under significant demographic trouble, from the Caucasus to Tatarstan, you know, Russia has more, arguably, than any other nation that touches on Europe, a problem with Islamic extremists and the terrorism and the threat that it comes to the natural culture, really, than anybody else. But given that reality for the Russians, they also are supporting the world's most powerful Islamic extremist nation, which is Iran, whether it's nuclear, whether it's geopolitical top cover in some respects. And some people say it's just economics, but you would hope that there's more than just money involved in this. What do you see as the big driver behind Russia's continual backing and support of Iran, who is just down the street from them?
Well, let me second your statement about Russian concern for Islamic extremism. Now, to some extent, it's ethnic extremists in Russia, not liking Russians, who are now flouting their Islamism. Nonetheless, it's a huge difficulty for Russia, and it is another one of those things that we do have in common with them that perhaps we haven't been able to take full advantage of, again, because of the suspicions that that we have or that they have about us. On the score of Iran, I do tend to see it as an economic situation largely. Russia wants influence there, yes. Understands that Iran is an extremely influential power in the region for a lot of reasons. But they've been making serious money for a long time selling, again, ostensibly peaceful nuclear stuff to Iran, the Natanz, for, gosh, 3 or 4 or 5 years, over several billion dollars they've gotten from that. I don't think that they're too concerned about Islamism when it comes to Iran. I really do think that they're thinking more about having influence with a large regional power and making a buck. Remember now, the Russian economy makes its money almost in a very feudal and third world way. They sell minerals to people. They don't sell services. They don't sell jet airplanes. That's not true. They sell military stuff to other countries. They make money that way. But largely, they sell minerals to other countries. Here, you have sort of a unique opportunity where there's some reasonably high technology that's being sold to another country. And I think that Russia is very proud to be able to do that because so little of their economy is sophisticated enough to export around the world. This is one case that it actually does. And so that's a feather in their cap. And I think that they're willing to look the other way when it comes to extremism with respect to Iran.
Well, let's talk a bit about more about Russia's economy. I have not heard much good news out of Russia in quite a while. Maybe you can be the one, the bearer of good news for me, that Russia's economy is strong and thriving, that they're using their exportation of minerals to develop a powerful economy, well, to take them out of the third world status or whatever they're in now. Well, have you got good news along those lines?
Tommy, still with us?
I'll comment on the Russian economy. The term BRIC came up not too long ago. Some Wall Street banker, I guess, came up with it, and Russia was the R in BRIC. And a lot of people have been making fun of that because the Russian economy has not developed nearly as dynamically as Brazil's or India or China. Nonetheless, as long as the price of oil is high, money is going to be coming into Russia. They haven't made a huge effort to have it trickle down. Yes, there's still corruption, et cetera. But the average Russian does live qualitatively better today than he did 10 or 20 years ago. It's a, if not a success story, at least the trends over the 20 years have been positive. And I continue to be optimistic that the Russian economy is going to be in reasonably good shape. It just doesn't have enough entrepreneurial savvy to compete with other BRIC nations like India, for example. I honestly feel my pet theory is that some combination of Lenin and Stalin took the backbone out of most Russians because they realized that whenever they lifted their head out of the foxhole, it usually got shot off. So they stopped being, you know, initiative takers. They're not capitalists at heart. Nonetheless, they're well-educated. They have a lot of resources. They have quite a few people, even though they're losing people. And they've got the capability of having a strong economy, just not at the very highest level. That might come with time. It hasn't come yet. But it isn't that they're a basket case. It is still that they are slowly but steadily on their way up. And, you know, let's keep driving big cars and keep the price of oil high, and the Russian economy will continue to be in pretty good shape.
The, continuing east on Russia, with the about 10 years after the Mexican-American War, where we got what is most of the western U.S. from Mexico, the Russians did something very similar with what they call the Far East and others call Outer Manchuria, which used to be Chinese, Manchurian, whatever label you want to put on it. And it's still a source of friction in some ways. And you see cropping up in the press now and then, and even in some Chinese maps, even in Taiwan, you can see where they claim that that's still Chinese. Is that one of those frozen conflicts that we should be worried about is sometime in the near future from a resource and a demographics requirement? Or is that pretty well settled between the Chinese and the Russian people, that border?
I take that issue seriously, and I'll just offer an anecdote. When I was attaché, and I was the bag holder for who was the SINCPAC Admiral Preer at the time, he met with the Russian four-star, who was the leader of the Far East Military District. And we went out on his yacht in the Ussuri River, catching sturgeon and opening the sturgeon and eating the caviar literally out of the sturgeon's belly. One of those great experiences. And I remember when the admiral and the general sat down and spoke, and after four or five vodkas, which is the standard way that generals and admirals talk, the Russian general was absolutely, when Admiral Preer said, "What's on your mind?" he couldn't shut him up on what might have been called 100 years ago in the Hearst Press, the Yellow Peril. The number of Chinese swimming the Ussuri River on any given day, he doesn't have enough troops to stop them. And ultimately, Chinese are expansive demographically. I don't mean in a military sense, but there are more and more Chinese. Similarly, Russians own Siberia and populated Siberia back in the good old communist days by the Communist Party paying triple wages to anyone who was willing to go out and live in Irkutsk. I mean, my God, who would want to live in Irkutsk? But if you went there, you got extra special money. Even Vladivostok, you got extra pays if you went out to Vlad, and Vlad isn't so bad. Now that Russians are capitalists, and that triple wage isn't there anymore, Russians are all running back to Petersburg and Moscow and the safer confines. And so you have a huge demographic imbalance happening in Siberia right now. And I really don't think it's outlandish to think that not the near term, maybe not even the midterm, but certainly in the far term, large chunks of real estate out there, you'll look around and you'll just see mostly Chinese living there. And ultimately, Russia will have a very difficult time sustaining sovereignty over lands that are populated largely by Chinese. Whether this is the stuff of war, who knows? But the Chinese are going to have an increasingly good case if they choose to make it. Now, when you look at what the Chinese are doing in the South China Sea, maybe they will, because they're making some outlandish claims down there. But I'm not optimistic about the Russian future in Siberia unless they can do something about demography. And they've been signally unsuccessful on that score now for 20 years.
Well, we're coming up onto the end of the show, and I'm going to ask one of those global questions, which, in case I haven't asked enough of them already, but as you look forward with NATO and Russia, what things do you see that we need to be really watching in the next 3 or 4 years that would make a major difference in our lives?
Well, as long as we've got the Article 5 out there, I don't see big breakthroughs happening. If we're going to have breakthroughs with Russia, I think we're going to have to do it bilaterally with them. I just spoken to too many Russian diplomats in Brussels and around the world to think that with Article 5 out there, that they're somehow going to convince themselves that they literally are going to be, you know, like available for membership in NATO, to be a real member of the team. And so I'm just not optimistic that can go very far. I do think that we've got the potential bilaterally. They really respect the United States. They respect American power. Whenever I used to be in a room of attachés, the Russian would like to always come over to me and say, let's the two of us go talk, the two superpowers. Let's not be bothered by Estonia and South Africa. Superpowers need to talk with one another. They really do respect the United States, and I think that there are some good opportunities for us with respect to ballistic missile defense, START negotiations, cooperative endeavors around the world. I just am less optimistic about Russia-NATO as long as that Article 5 is out there.
Well, Tom, this has been a very, very fast hour, and thank you very much for taking some time out of your weekend holiday to come on MidRats. It's been a great show, and look forward to an opportunity down the road to perhaps have you on again.
Well, you promised it would be fast, and it absolutely was. So now I get an opportunity to go back and start power washing my decks again.
It's a good enjoy your dacha, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot,
okay.
Tom.
All right.
we know you're nice and cool up there in the mountains.
It's wonderful. A sun setting on Fourth Lake up here in the Adirondacks, and I got to be loving it.
And thanks, everybody, who joined us live, for those who give us on archive. And I hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love.